All right, Alexander, let's discuss the news about Rasputin. And I guess the first question that I have to ask you, because we're going to kind of look back at everything that's happened that has brought us to this point. My first question is a question I think is on everybody's mind. Is he really dead?
Yep, he is really dead. But it's good that you've asked this question because the stories that are circulating are absolutely wild and fantastical. And the people who are contributing to these wild and fantastical stories are his murderers. They are giving stories. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. These people who have actually carried out a murder in full public view are wandering freely around Petrograd, St. Petersburg, giving interviews, talking about things, discussing how they carried out this murder. And they're spreading absolutely ludicrous, I mean, absolutely fantastical stories about Rasputin and about what happened. And of course, they're reinforcing this idea that we're dealing with some kind of mythological personality. And that, of course, is again leading to questions about whether this man is really dead or not. But there's an enormous amount of fantasy and legend making going on. I should say that I've been able to get hold of the police reports, the police records of the investigation into Rasputin's death. The police have done an incredibly thorough job, and they basically identified everybody who's been involved. And I've also read not the autopsy report itself, because that is somehow mysteriously going missing. But there's a document which seems to reflect fairly closely what the autopsy report actually says. And besides, the medical people who carried out the autopsy have also been giving their accounts of what they found. And if you compare the police reports and the autopsy, the comments of the people who carried out the autopsy, with all the legends and fantasies and rumors and stories, you begin to get a fairly good idea about what happened and the fact that Rasputin most definitely is dead, and that these fantasies that have been spread have no basis in reality.
Who killed him? Who
Right.
killed him?
Right. Now, this is where we come directly to the key point about this. Now, in order to get to an understanding of why, of who killed Rasputin, we have to ask the question, which is always a good question to ask whenever a murder takes place: why did he die? Now, there is, over the last couple of months, being a growing sense of political crisis in Russia. And we discussed in our previous program how the very powerful liberal bloc in the Duma, who are associated with the Speaker of the Duma, Mr. Rodzianko, have been leveraging their control of Russia's war economy, which they've consolidated by setting up these so-called voluntary associations to try to get concessions, political concessions from the Tsar. They have been talking openly over the last few months about creating what they call a government of national confidence. A government of national confidence means, of course, a government led and headed by themselves. I mean, they work themselves up into what appears to be the genuine belief that they are somehow popular in the country. I see no evidence of that at all, by the way. I think that's a fundamental misreading of the situation. But they are strong in the Duma, which, remember, has a restricted franchise. And this has enabled them, in conjunction with their control of the war economy, to steadily chip away at the Tsar's reputation. At the same time as that has been happening, the Tsar himself, who's clearly been getting increasingly stressed by the situation in St. Petersburg. I'm going to continue to call it St. Petersburg, by the way. I don't like this new name, Petrograd, that's been foisted on it. He took the extraordinary decision to absent himself from St. Petersburg, to make himself commander-in-chief of the Russian army, which I think most people would agree was actually the correct decision. The previous commander, Grand Prince Nikolai Nikolaevich, was completely out of his depth and wasn't able to run things properly, and was in any event obviously engaging in intrigues himself, which were directed against Nicholas. So that was the correct decision, but he basically made it a bad decision by leaving St. Petersburg and going to this place, Mogilev, far away from St. Petersburg, far from anywhere important, in fact, surrounding himself with the staff and generals and people of that kind, and leaving the situation in St. Petersburg to fester increasingly out of control. So we've had this political crisis, the challenge of the liberals to the Tsar and to the Tsar's government. Now, what has at the same time happened is that the Tsar himself has been increasingly losing confidence in the people who lead his government. And that goes back to the point that we've discussed previously in so many previous programs, that without Stolypin, who was this strong personality, this man who had an ability to control the government, but he was also at the same time loyal to the Tsar, with him gone, the Tsar, Nicholas, has been unable to find anyone who can effectively replace him. Nicholas himself doesn't like the day-to-day business of routine administration. He isn't good at that. But he hasn't been able to find somebody to take Stolypin's place. So firstly, we had Goromykin, who, as I said, was a good man, an honest man, a loyal person, honest by all accounts, but old and indecisive and hardly the kind of person who you could expect to run a war economy effectively and lead a nation at war. He was then replaced by a man called Baron Sturmer, who was a sort of middle-ranking official that nobody had ever heard of. And we're going to come to this because there's lots of suspicions and rumours that Rasputin had a hand in his appointment. We're going to come to that shortly. Then Sturmer was dismissed and replaced by another person called Trepov. And then Trepov hasn't lasted very long, and he's been replaced by someone else called Galitsyn. So we're having a whole succession of different people being appointed to the post of prime minister. And then alongside that, we're having serious disruption of the officials in the interior ministry. So we're having a whole procession of officials being appointed to the key post of interior minister. Now, again, for summer of 1916, Nicholas appointed a man to the job called Khvostov. Khvostov, by all accounts, is a sociopath, a thoroughly corrupt and extraordinarily unstable person. Again, many people think that it was Rasputin who had a hand in his appointment. Anyway, Khvostov was pushed aside, and Nicholas, in a gesture to the Duma, to the liberals, then took the bizarre decision, at least I think it was bizarre, to appoint to the post of interior minister. This is the man who runs the intelligence and security services, whose job it is, in effect, to protect the government, to keep an eye on plots and conspiracies. Anyway, Nicholas decided that he was going to appoint a member of the liberal bloc of the Duma, a man called Protopopov, to the post of interior minister. Now, what then happened was he appointed Protopopov. Protopopov has proved to be utterly incompetent, but entirely predictably, the liberals in the Duma and the oligarchs and people like Rodzianko, who is the speaker of the Duma, they weren't satisfied with Protopopov's appointment. They weren't appeased by it in any way. On the contrary, they went ahead and went on to criticise the decision. They said that this was absolutely unacceptable. It's not acceptable for Nicholas to appoint liberals without first clearing it with them. So he got, as a result, the worst of all worlds. Now, what has led to that is a massive collapse in support for Nicholas amongst conservatives. And because conservatives in Russia don't like to criticize the person of the Tsar, they have instead started to criticize Rasputin instead. Rasputin has become the lightning conductor for criticism that is basically the anger that's felt towards the Tsar. It's become increasingly focused instead on Rasputin. And what we had in November, in the lead up to Rasputin's assassination, we had two speeches in the Duma. The first was on the 1st of November, and it was by a man called Vladimir Purishkevich, who is known to be one of the strongest, most articulate and forceful right-wingers in the Duma. And Purishkevich made an extraordinary, incendiary speech in which he attacked Rasputin and made him responsible for the whole crisis that's brewing in the country. And he openly stated what many people are now saying, that the Empress, who is by German my nationality, is engaged in some kind of conspiracy with Rasputin to derail Russia's war effort. It was an unbelievable speech. And he talked, Purishkevich talked, about ministerial leapfrog, about the fact that there's this extraordinary instability amongst the ministers. And then, a short time later, in mid-November, one of the most important liberals, a man called Pavel Miliukov, got up in the Duma and made what is essentially an identical speech to Purishkevich. Remember, Purishkevich is on the extreme right. Miliukov is perhaps the leading liberal in the Duma. Anyway, but here they are both saying essentially the same thing, that there's treason at the heart of the Russian government. He says that, you know, he asked repeatedly this rhetorical question, is it incompetence or is it treason that the Russian war effort isn't going as well as Miliukov would like it to? And again, hinting very openly that Rasputin was somehow involved in all of this. So you see this huge head of steam beginning to build up on the part basically of the right, but exploited by the liberal left, trying, in the case of the liberals, to discredit the Tsar and the Empress by association with Rasputin, and to weaken them by associating Nicholas with Rasputin. And at the same time, we see this massive anger on the right, which blames Rasputin for the mistakes, as they see it, that the Tsar is making. Now, the people who murdered Rasputin were people on the right. I think that's the first thing to say. I mentioned Purishkevich. Purishkevich was the lead conspirator. He was one of the people who was actually involved in murdering Rasputin himself. But members of the imperial family were also involved. The Grand Prince Dmitry Pavlovich, who is a member of the imperial family, was directly implicated in the murder, as was someone else, Prince Felix Yusupov. Now, he is a member of the imperial family because the Yusupov family that he belongs to, one of the great aristocratic families of Russia, is heavily intermarried with the Romanovs, with the dynasty, and are virtually a branch of the dynasty. And his wife, Xenia, is in fact a Romanov princess. So you can see that it was people within the court, on the right, led by Purishkevich, who carried out this murder. And it was carried out, as we now know, in the palace on the Fontanka, which is one of the canals in St. Petersburg, in the palace of Prince Yusupov. And I would add that in the hours just before this murder took place, Protopopov, the interior minister, who is, remember, supposed to be aligned with the liberals, or was aligned with the liberals, but is now being criticized by them. He had a secret meeting, as it turns out, with Rasputin in Rasputin's apartment. And again, one wonders what that was all about. Some people think he was trying to warn Rasputin. Others, perhaps more plausibly, think he was trying to lure him to his death by encouraging him to meet up with these people who were Rasputin's eventual assassins. So he was murdered. Rasputin has been murdered because the right is angry that he's got so close to the Tsar, and they're blaming him for the problems that the government is having, for the Tsar's mistakes. And the liberals also wanted him dead because, from their point of view, that further discredits the Tsar and amplifies, if you like, the Tsar's extraordinary bad judgment in allowing this extraordinary man, Rasputin, to get so close to his family.
Yeah, okay, so that's what I want to talk about. As we finish the video, I want to get into some of the discussion, the talks, the rumors about how Rasputin died, actually the details of it, because there are a lot of people that are saying some very extraordinary things.
Yeah.
Maybe they're true, maybe they're not, but we'll discuss that later on in the video. But right now, the question that I have on my mind is, how did Rasputin get into this position? Why was he given so much power? We talked about the vacuum that was created when Nicholas decided to take over the military operation and move to the front lines. We've talked about Rasputin's closeness to Alexandra and to the family as well, to the royal family. How did Rasputin maneuver into this position to begin with?
Well, it's absolutely clear that the Empress Alexandra is psychologically dependent, became psychologically dependent on him. Obviously, he seems to have had some capacity to calm and reassure the Tsarevich, Alexei, who is clearly ill in some way. There's rumours that he has haemophilia, which we've discussed. And he also seems to have had some kind of calming effect on Alexandra herself. Alexandra has always had a mystical turn of mind. She feels very isolated in the court. Her mother-in-law, the Empress Dowager, detests her and has been trying to isolate her. So she's reached out to Rasputin, who she sees as some kind of link between the imperial family, between the inner family and the mass of the people of Russia. The story that they're having an affair is complete nonsense, but of course it's gained a great deal of traction. Everybody knows that Alexandra and Nicholas are devoted to each other, but she has this psychological dependency on Rasputin. Now, so long as Nicholas was in St. Petersburg, his mere presence kept the whole thing under some sort of control. Rasputin wasn't excessively visible. He wasn't around the palace all the time. And there was some kind of check, if you like, on his activities. The moment Nicholas went off to Mogilev, the moment he sort of, if you like, deserted his post, went absent without leave, left St. Petersburg and went to Mogilev, it became less clear who was in actual charge of things in St. Petersburg itself. Remember, we have this massive instability in the government with prime ministers each replacing each other one after the other. But on top of that, we have the further factor that without Nicholas, the attention has been much more on the Empress herself. She's become the most visible person of the imperial family in St. Petersburg and in the court. And that inevitably has made Rasputin himself look much more prominent than he did. And one of the other things that has happened is that without Nicholas present, it's become increasingly clear that Rasputin himself began to behave in an increasingly irresponsible way. He became involved with a whole bunch of adventurers One of them was an individual who calls himself Prince Andronikov. There's some question about whether he's actually a real prince. He's not Russian. He's from Georgia. But anyway, he floats around St. Petersburg. Nobody seems to know quite what he does, but he seems to have set himself up as Rasputin's advisor in some form. And there's widespread suspicion that he takes bribes and has been urging Rasputin to urge the empress, to urge the Tsar to appoint all kinds of people to ministerial posts, people who have been paying Andronikov bribes. So I mentioned people like Sturmer, for example, other people like Khvostov, the interior minister. There's been some suggestion that those people have been appointed in that way. But Andronikov is bad enough. As I said, he's not at all liked in St. Petersburg. But an even more bizarre and eccentric character is an individual. We don't even know exactly what his name is, but some people called him Ivan Manusevich. Others called him Ivan Manuilov. He's often referred to, he gets a double-barreled name, Ivan Manasevich Manuilov. He's some kind of businessman. He previously worked in the Russian intelligence services. He's known to be some sort of an adventurer, and he is quite unbelievably corrupt and a blackmailer. And again, he too seems to have acquired some kind of relationship with Rasputin. And again, there is rumours that he too has been advising Rasputin on ministerial, on urging the empress to make ministerial appointments and taking bribes. And by the way, perhaps more, dangerously, has been using his supposed influence over Rasputin to blackmail officials by threatening to criticize them to Rasputin and get Rasputin to tell bad things about them to the empress, who then supposedly would then pass them on to Nicholas himself. So this has created incredibly bad feeling in St. Petersburg. And again, one has to say that the reason this situation has got so completely out of hand is that Nicholas himself isn't there in St. Petersburg to keep all this sort of thing under control.
Yeah, but was Rasputin, the rumors are that Rasputin was actually running the country. I mean, is that true?
No, I mean, that's what makes this whole thing so completely absurd. We have some, as I said, I've looked at the various reports and the investigations. By the way, the Duma has been carrying out its own investigation into Rasputin. It's now absolutely clear that Rasputin has had minimal influence. In fact, it's not clear that he had any influence whatsoever. He did from time to time talk to the Empress, and the Empress would from time to time pass on his suggestions to Nicholas. But there is no evidence that Nicholas ever followed Rasputin's advice in making any sort of ministerial appointments or in making any kind of policy decisions. And bear something in mind. All of this has been happening, all this so-called crisis, all this talk about, to go back to Milyukov's phrase, is it incompetence or is it treason? All this has been happening over the course of a year, 1916, where the military situation for Russia has been improving with the Grand Prince Nikolai Nikolaevich out of the way, with professionals in charge of the army. The army is not only performing immeasurably better, but it has won a whole series of decisive victories. There was an important offensive commanded by General Brusilov, which ended in an extraordinary string of victories. So far from the situation getting worse, it's actually been getting better, except, of course, that there are problems on the home front, problems of supply to the cities, which unfortunately are again going unaddressed because Nicholas, as I said, isn't in the capital, and because the government itself is weak and unstable. But there's no evidence that Rasputin is running the country. And this myth that he and the emperors are plotting with Germany some kind of separate peace for Russia. Nobody who is truly familiar with the situation believes that at all. But it's a story that's been spread both by people on the right, like Purishkevich, and by the liberals, and appallingly by some members of the foreign, by some of the foreign ambassadors. The British ambassador, Mr. Buchanan, is known to have been spreading stories across the capital, also casting into doubt Alexandra's loyalty to Nicholas and to Russia, which is malicious gossip, and it's clearly manoeuvres in order to get Buchanan's liberal friends appointed to ministerial posts. So there is no truth to this story of Rasputin running the government or anything like that.
I mean, how deep are the problems, though, on the home front? And who's supposed to be addressing those?
Well, the last is an excellent question, because we don't really have a clear idea of who's in charge of anything at the moment. Because, as I said, in Nicholas's absence, and remember, to some extent,
that's the Tsar's mistake, though.
That's the Tsar's mistake. I mean, he should have stayed in the capital and took charge. I mean, he's good with the military side of things. He understands that. He was himself, remember, an army officer. He served in the army, not in a command capacity, but he understands soldiers. He understands generals. Generals like him. They work with him. He's able to improve the situation with the military. He appoints good professional people to important positions. But he's never been interested in the civilian administration of the country. And he's never found anybody who he can rely upon and who he feels is fully loyal to himself to do it for him. And so the result is nobody is running things well. The running of the war economy has been conceded to the liberals and their so-called progressive bloc and these so-called voluntary associations, which the oligarchs have set up, which is in itself a disastrous thing. I mean, that's an unbelievably foolish thing for a government at war to do, to let others run its war economy for it. And the government itself has no one who is, if you like, properly in charge of supply, especially supply of food to the cities, even though there is an abundance of food in Russia. And at the same time, and on top of all of that, we've had people like Khvostov, who, as I said, was a sociopath, but did seem to be loyal to the Tsar. Turned out that he wasn't. And Protopopov, who was appointed merely because he was, you know, associated to the liberals, but he was incompetent also. We've had people like that appointed to run the Interior Ministry, even though the Interior Ministry is absolutely crucial to keep the situation, the domestic situation in Russia, out of control, and it needs a strong, forceful, devoted and loyal personality to the Tsar to make sure, to ensure that that kind of ministry is run properly. So I have to say this, Nicholas does carry a lot of the blame for this situation. I know there's many people who are sorry for him, and given the kind of people he has to deal with in St. Petersburg, I mean, he has my every sympathy. But the fact of the matter is, he is the Tsar. It is his responsibility to take control, and he hasn't done so. He left the capital, he went to Mogilev, and he's now letting the situation slide.
It sounds to me, listening to you, that no one really knows who's running stuff on the domestic front.
No.
I mean, it sounds very ambiguous.
It sounds very ambiguous and very...
It's incredible to hear that, yeah.
And incredibly dangerous, because, as I said, bear in mind, this is a country at war, a nation at war. There's all the problems that come from the fact that the country is at war. The fact that, as I said, living standards are always affected. As I said, there's food shortages now, which is a critical situation. But bear in mind also that, you know, whilst all of these people, the liberals, the right, the Tsar, all of these people are fretting and frothing about Rasputin and his non-existent influence. There is a real organization which is operating in Russia and is increasing all the time in strength and power, and that is the organization that's led by Lenin. And the reports we're getting, and I gather that there are reports from people, police officials, they're trying to get through to the Tsar, they're trying to get through to the Interior Minister, but, you know, the Interior Ministry is read by people like Khvostov and now Protopopov, who, as I said, are incompetent and are more interested in intrigues than in keeping control control of the domestic situation. Anyway, what they are saying is that there's trouble brewing in the factories and that Lenin's organization is now almost in complete, unchallenged control of the mood, of the sentiments of the workers in the factories, because nobody's interested in countering it. The oligarchs, the liberals, are not interested in doing so, even though they own the factories, because they're more interested in gaining power and pushing the Tsar to one side. The Tsar is away in Mogilev, and the conservatives have got distracted with this issue of Rasputin. So it's an incredibly dangerous situation. Now, can I actually say a few things about Rasputin's murder? Because, as I said, there's been a lot of wild stories.
I mean, I'm just real quick, I've heard yeah. he was poisoned and shot and drowned. And,
yeah.
They made him eat poison cakes and you name it, they did it to him. And he just kept on going and going what's the story here?
I mean, the point you're about to say about that, all those stories have been spread by the assassins themselves, by Purishkevich and Yusupov and the Grand Prince Dmitry Pavlovich. Now, the reason they're spreading all of that is because they want to reinforce the story that Rasputin was this sort of demonic figure who could survive poisoning by cyanide, and you know, you could shoot at him and it didn't affect him, and they had to then eventually take him away and throw him into the river and under the ice, and even that didn't fully kill him. I mean, all those bizarre stories. Now, we actually have, as I said, the police reports. And we also have now reports from the doctors. The first thing to say is the doctors found no trace of cyanide in him. So, I mean, the whole story about him being poisoned with cyanide is completely untrue. I mean, it's either invented or he was poisoned with something that probably wasn't cyanide. I mean, that's the only explanation one can come up with. He was badly beaten before he was killed. He was lured to the Yusupov Palace. He was lured, apparently, by an invitation, which Protopopov, the interior minister, who, remember, is supposed to be a liberal, but, you know, liberals and conservatives seem to have been involved in all of this. Protopopov might have extended it. Anyway, a car came along to Rasputin's apartment. By the way, I should quickly say, Rasputin himself, despite what people say, doesn't seem to have been interested in wealth and money. He lived very simply. He lived in a very ordinary apartment. He doesn't seem to have been, in that respect, a corrupt man. But anyway, he was lured from this apartment to a party at the Yusupov Palace. There were women there, one of whom, by the way, is the ballet dancer, Vera Karali. There is actually film, you can find it on YouTube, of Vera Karali dancing. She is the lover of one of the assassins, Dmitry Pavlovich. Anyway, he went to this party. He was beaten. He was very severely beaten. This is something that the stories don't convey. And then he was shot three times, once in the forehead. And that shot, well, all three of those shots would have killed him, but the one through the forehead would have been mortal. It would have been a fatal killing. And then his body was indeed dumped in the river. And because of rigor mortis, he got into all sorts of strange positions, which sometimes happens with rigor mortis. And some people seen the photographs and see his arms outstretched, and they thought that this meant that he was clinging to the ice and that he was still alive when he was thrown into the river. But it's actually a symptom of rigor mortis. So he was killed. He was first lured to this place, then severely beaten, and then shot. The story about the poison is absolute nonsense. Obviously, there's all kinds of things which we don't fully understand, but we do know who was there. We do know who carried out the murder, because something absolutely bizarre and very weird happened after Rasputin was killed, which is that near to the Yusupov Palace, there is a police station, and the police were hearing all this strange activity going on in the palace, and they were hearing all these shots being fired. So they turned up at the palace and knocked on the door and asked what was happening. And they were invited in by no less a person than Purishkevich himself, who was clearly the ringleader. And he took them up. He took the police officers upstairs and he said, "Oh, you know, we've just murdered Rasputin. We've just freed Russia from this demonic man. And if you're loyal to the Tsar, you won't disclose the facts to anybody." So, of course, the police officers went back to the police station. They completed a report. They included in it all the details of this bizarre conversation with Purishkevich. And it went straight up to the Tsar. And, of course, that immediately identified who the murderers were. Very bizarre. And it does beg the question about how in touch with reality people like Purishkevich and some of the other assassins actually are. But anyway, after that, as I said, it was they who spread all of these stories. And for reasons which again point to the Tsar's weakness, instead of him having all of these people arrested, which he should have done, and tried for murdering Rasputin, he has closed the investigation down and he's asked them to leave the capital. Now, that again highlights or indicates to people in the capital that he's losing control. It's a disastrous misstep, in my opinion. And of course,
but
it's
why?
Well, why the
well, what's the rumor? Logic?
The rumor of this is that he came under incredible pressure from his mother, who also detested Rasputin, and who may have had some kind of role in encouraging these assassins. But then again, the Tsar should have disregarded all of this and let the investigation take its course. And of course, by short-circuiting the investigation, letting all of these people go free, two things have happened. One is that the Tsar looks weak at a critical time. And second, all those rumours about, you know, Rasputin eating poison cakes and all that nonsense, all of that is going around also unchallenged because it's not going to be rebutted in a proper investigation.
And what's the Empress going through right now? I mean, she's the one closest to Rasputin.
She is apparently in a state of incredible shock and real distress. I mean, she has taken this incredibly badly and is apparently in severe grief. And again, I have to say this, it seems to me that Nicholas's place is by her side. He needs to reassure her. The family needs to present a strong front. But instead of that, again, he's going away. Apparently, he's going to go back to Mogilev after. And in the meantime, the whole situation is just, as I said, one senses it's falling apart behind him. One wonders what Nicholas is thinking in these things. And one also has to say, I have to say this, one wonders about what kind of advice he's getting. It seems to me that he's just not getting proper advice about how bad the situation in the capital is.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way that you can answer this question that I have, an observation. But I mean, is not the Empress upset knowing that her husband is letting the killers go free?
Absolutely, of course she is. She must be deeply upset about it. She's distraught about it, and one wonders whether there haven't been recriminations and arguments about this, and whether that might be one of the reasons why the Tsar is leaving St. Petersburg, that he's again unwilling to face his wife. I will say this for Nicholas, and this is a point that I think people need to understand. The unfortunate man has been worn down. He's never found loyalty on the part of anybody in the court. No one around him has worked for him loyally and straightforwardly and honestly. He's found instead that he has a court that is absolutely full of intrigue. And the basic reason for this is that the government, the Tsar, has been facing this extraordinary challenge, this concerted challenge from the liberals, who say things about Nicholas that is just off, you know, that they're beyond abusive. They are defamatory in the most extreme and grotesque way. But for reasons which are complicated, but have become worse because, as I said, he doesn't feel able to control, to assert his control over them. He feels that he needs their help because they run the war economy and things of this kind. He's not prepared to crack down on them. So the result is that because he's facing all this abuse, he's facing all these intrigues, he's facing this consistent and sustained challenge to his position by the liberals, who, by the way, I think he absolutely rightly believes are corrupt, self-seeking and utterly incompetent. The idea that they could successfully lead Russia in war is just a fantasy. So, you know, the fact that he's refusing to appoint them to senior posts isn't just because he, you know, wants to keep it all himself. He quite rightly believes that they would make an absolute mess of things if they took charge, and that their real loyalties aren't anyway to Russia, but to themselves and to their British and French friends. So because he's faced all of this, I think that's made St. Petersburg an almost intolerable place for him. If he'd had some element of core support within the aristocracy, within the political elite, within the Duma, within the governmental structures, he would, I think, have felt much more inclined to remain in the capital and do his job. He hasn't found that. And so the result is that he's fled to the generals and to the military, where he finds that loyalty and that support and that integrity and that essential competence that just doesn't exist in the capital. But unfortunately, whilst one can understand that and sympathise with it at a human level, it is creating an extremely dangerous situation in the capital. And one has to wonder, frankly, whether just leaving St. Petersburg in this way isn't going to invite massive trouble.
Yeah, I think it's a gigantic mistake. Seeing everything that's just happened, after seeing everything that's happened with Rasputin, he decides to once again get up and leave. I mean, it's almost like everything that's gone on with Rasputin and the murder of Rasputin was like a warning saying to Nicholas, look, stay around the capital. Don't leave. There's a lot of trouble going on here. There's a lot of palace intrigue. There's problems on the home front. You need to stay here. Look at what just happened with Rasputin and everything going on. Stay here and sort that out. Instead, he leaves, and he's just inviting trouble.
Absolutely. What he should have done is he should have gone to the Duma, proposed a competent prime minister. And my own view is that the obvious place to look for someone like that would have been someone in the military. And I think the country would have responded well to the appointment of a top general staff officer to the post of prime minister. He should then have, as well as the Duma, he should have visited the military and police units. He should have appointed someone to take charge of the interior ministry. He should have made himself as visible as possible and given the strong impression that he was in full control, and he should have seen this investigation about Rasputin through to the end. Had he done that, I suspect the situation in the capital would have stabilised. Because bear in mind, a military officer, a prime minister drawn from the military would have been a difficult person for the liberals to criticise, because they claim to be as supportive of the war effort as everybody else. And it would have been very difficult, it seems to me, for them to criticise a military officer, a person in military charge who represented the army in wartime. And somebody with, you know, the knowledge of staff matters, with those kind of organisational skills, able to draw perhaps on the enormous organisational and administrative resources that exist in Russia, in places like the General Staff and elsewhere, could have probably got on top of the supply problems very quickly, and could have worked probably well with the military leadership in the conduct of the war. But Nicholas hasn't done that. He's instead appointing this extremely nice, very affable, very likeable man, Prince Golitsyn, from one of the oldest families in Russia, aristocracy that goes back in Russian history to well before Peter the Great's time. Everybody likes him. Everybody sees him as a total lightweight, not in any conceivable way the sort of person who can effectively assert control. And one wonders again why Nicholas is making these bad decisions. And one has to say that at some level, I suspect it's again because he's finding that he's worried that if he took that bold decision of appointing someone, like I said, like a soldier to run the government, there would be massive opposition from the liberals, which I don't think there would be, in fact. And he's afraid of facing it. So he ends up with a weak prime minister, a disorganised government, and an extremely fractured and disintegrating political situation in the capital. This isn't going to end well.
Yeah, and Lenin on the rise.
And Lenin on the rise. Without anybody, without any of the people we're talking about seeming to grasp the fact. I mean, this is the other thing that makes this whole situation so surreal. They're all talking, they're all intriguing and conspiring against each other, and they don't seem to understand that they're talking in circles whilst the real political challenge to them is growing all the time, led by a man who is utterly single-minded in his focus and utterly ruthless in his drive for power.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there. TheDuran.locals.com. Everybody, take care.